Accessing library computer data.
And to make sure history never forgets the name Enterprise.
Hey everybody, welcome to the Penske Podcast. If you haven't tuned in before, this is a podcast where we are running through all 178 episodes of Star Trek The Next Generation, giving our thoughts and feelings about each and every one. Right now we're up to episode 5 of season 5. This one is called Disaster. It's directed by Gabriel Beaumont. Teleplay goes to Ronald D. Moore, and the story goes to Ron Jarvis and Philip Scorza. It aired back on October 21, 1991. I think I've said October 21, 1991 for the past three episodes. I don't know if that's a mistake on Wikipedia or it was just a day of Star Trek in history. Anyway, in this one, the crew of the Enterprise are undertaking routine tasks when suddenly the ship is struck by some outside force, rendering much of it inoperable and many of the crew stranded in various locations. Eric and Richard from Trekabout are going to be talking Disaster with me, so right after this, we're going to go deep on Disaster.
There are a lot of people still alive. Many of them are hurt, but I can't tell where they are.
We need to start emergency procedures. Who's the duty officer?
Lieutenant Monroe was in command, but she's dead. I believe Counselor Troy is the senior officer on the deck.
Counselor Troy?
She carries the rank of Lieutenant Commander.
I'd appreciate some suggestions.
You know, for as interesting as an episode as I think Disaster is, I could not come up with a decent way to sort of segue into the podcast, which is always something that I like to enjoy doing. I like to somehow bring up something that's going on related to anything, but this is a difficult one to do. I went through like the Poseidon Adventure. I think that's a little bit too dated of a reference to sort of go to, but I don't know. Has anyone here, I'm a East Coaster from Boston and I've never been in a natural disaster. Has anyone here experienced a natural disaster?
Well, not a natural disaster. Well,
oh, yeah, anytime. No, anytime there was a hurricane, you would like have a panic. You'd be like, we got to go to the store, and you'd take us to the store, and you know, there'd be like 5 million people, and you'd buy all this water, you would fill the bathtub up with water, and like nothing would happen.
It's good to be prepared.
You know, I would like make sure that, you know, I had liquor and pot, and that was like just the way I dealt with blizzards, but you know, you got all this food and stuff. And
I think it depends on how you define natural disaster. I mean, I've been through blizzards and I've been through two hurricanes. I mean, we were in New York during Sandy. I mean, that wasn't great. So
yeah, that's true. Sandy didn't make it up here. I guess the real, we get the like the,
even Sandy didn't want to go to Boston.
Sandy didn't want anything to do with it. But we get like the we had like, I'm sure New York felt it. There was like a very minor earthquake in like Nova Scotia a couple years ago where the building shook a little bit.
And I felt that, yeah.
I was in the subway when that happened and I didn't notice it at all.
I thought I was at my cubicle and I thought I was passing out because like the it just started waving around in front of me and then it stopped and that was pretty much it. So, I mean, besides blizzards, I've never been in any sort of situation where I've been, you know, cut off from others or any kind of like grand failure of any kind of level. But that's what we're going to talk about here, because the Enterprise is going to crash into a quantum filament, which is not the same as a cosmic string, you idiots. And, and everything goes haywire. And I guess I wanted to start this one off with you guys, if I haven't introduced, this is Richard and Eric from Trekabout, the podcast. We're going to talk about Disaster. And one thing I've noticed, season 5, we started with Redemption, me and Clay, and we noticed that in season 5, a big difference from the way that the show had previously been is the show is really pushing the number of storylines that it's willing to have in a single episode. Mm. Redemption had a whole bunch of different arcs. This one's a little bit different because everyone's kind of in the same situation, but it's still a little bit. The show never really was comfortable splitting characters off to the extent that they are now. What did you guys think about how they did in Disaster in terms of that?
Yeah, this is a very interesting storyline because it is a bunch of moving parts and, you know, everybody is very cut off from each other and they're very good at picking combinations of characters that don't really spend time together. Like Worf and Keiko, for example, you know, they don't really ever have interactions with each other and now they're at a very intimate and, you know, heightened, you know, moment together and it works very well, you know, in giving that it, you know, gives more insight into both of those characters.
Yeah, and I think it also helps the episode feel a little bit, maybe a little bit more interesting or organic, because if you had an episode like this, I mean, they've done episodes like this before, and if you have just one or two stories, that actual story needs to be a lot tighter. Whereas if you go, I mean, we have Worf and Keiko in 10 Forward. We have the story with Riker and Data trying to get to engineering, and Riker's taking Data's head off. You know, we have the bridge crew with O'Brien, Troy, and Ro. And then we also have Picard in the turbo lift with the kids.
Yep.
And I think that, you know, these four stories, if any one of them, or perhaps even like there was a main A story with the bridge crew, and there was a B story with Riker and Data trying to get to engineering, I don't think that the episode would hang together nearly as well, because having these individual like four different stories allows each one to reach its limit, and you don't really have to artificially increase the tension or increase the stakes or sort of overwrite those scenes if each one had to hang together for 20 or 25 minutes of the running time of the episode.
Yeah, it also helps make the disaster seem that much more bad, frankly, because, you know, again, if you just have one story we're following, all right, that's fine, but you have four very different storylines, and you know, that also implies that there's, you know, we could go to any one of a dozen other storylines of just random people and how they're fixing something. And again, given that all four stories are very different problems that they're dealing with, Troy is dealing with the vagaries of command. Riker and Data are just dealing with a major physical challenge, you know.
Yeah. They're dealing with their secret love for each other.
Aw, it's not that secret. Now you see, if this was Geordi and Wesley, they're just huddling together and, you know, crying.
I'm glad they did not. Well, Wesley was off the ship at this point, right?
So, yeah, he's gone.
Yeah, that was a good call on our part.
Geordi is holding his Wesley doll and crying.
Well, I completely forgot the fifth story, of course, which is Geordi and Beverly Crusher.
My God, yeah.
There's five stories, yep.
Went nowhere. But anyway, that's not important.
I was about to say, like, hey, Geordi wasn't in the episode, was he?
Well, I think it speaks to the, like, you mentioned it goes nowhere. The Geordi and Beverly one, they're kind of the sort of odd characters out, because I was watching it. I was like, oh, like, yeah, that's nice. It's like, I'm not sure Beverly and Geordi have ever shared a scene together. And then I thought about it. It's like, oh, they've actually shared a lot of scenes together in sickbay because of his visor.
Yeah, yeah.
But you just don't remember it, really. Like, it doesn't feel like a natural pairing that would go well together. Their storyline is also sort of the weirdest, because it's basically a lesser version of the Riker-Data storyline.
Yeah, they have a plasma fire they need to put out, and they succeed, and it's kind of like...
it's nothing deeply thematic. It's just, you know, two people, you know, working together, and, you know, that's fine. I like it, but...
Well, which I think is interesting, too, because I think it does speak to kind of the one of the joys of TNG, which is just that you're watching... You're watching Starfleet officers and characters that are exceptionally good at what they do. And, you know, if they're able to overcome the challenges, these pretty extraordinary challenges, frankly, that, I mean, the Enterprise is basically, you know, disabled and just sort of floating in space. And they're able to overcome these challenges. I think it's kind of just nice to see people working together and doing a really good job in cooperation at the end of the day. That's what solves the problem. I think we don't see enough of that now, I think.
Yeah, and I would say, frankly, doing stuff that's outside of their general area. I mean, we have a doctor and an engineer, and they're doing, you know, lifting heavy things and, you know, doing some extraordinary physical ability, you know, but they're still doing it because they, you know, this crew is the best of the best. I mean, this is, you know, one of the things I was thinking about with this episode is how much Starfleet encourages extracurriculars on the part of its members.
Yeah.
I mean, this, you know, this storyline will ultimately lead to Troy deciding to take the command test herself. And as we learn in the same episode, when Troy does that much later on, Crusher, in the meantime, takes the command test herself, and she kind of just says, you know, yeah, you know, she kind of just does it for the hell of it because she just wanted to do something different, you know. Something more. And I mean, the Crusher and Geordi storyline begins with Crusher doing another one of her damn plays and trying to recruit Geordi to do that. I mean, I really like how much the officers are encouraged to, like, write poetry or do plays or just do these other, like, or have, we'll do a little concert. Like, that, I don't know, that kind of really, I like that Starf, you know, one of the things we see a lot in Next Generation, but in general, is that Starfleet does push its members to become more and better than they are. And
yep.
I don't know, it, 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 it pushes them in more than just a military way. You know, a good officer is very culturally knowledgeable, is very, you know, knows command as well as their own job.
It's kind of a problem of the show. The show always deals with scale very badly. Like me and other guests have always laughed about, like, the physics of why spaceships are so close to each other doesn't make any sense. They do it obviously because they have to film it and look at things like that kind of way. But you know, like the way that they portray battle scenes is if these ships are miles and miles and miles and miles apart from each other. You know, like that's why they miss and they move so slowly, and it's all sort of scales all screwed up. They also have a hard time telling you how much time is passing in a lot of episodes. In a lot of episodes, it's very curious about how much time the show expects you to think is passing between places. And in the start of this episode, Picard has the opening captain's log about just saying, well, we don't have a mission for a couple days, so everyone's just kind of like relaxing and chilling in 10 forward, which is funny that they have this off time that the show never really talks about, just because it's such a narrative drain, I suppose. If nothing's going on, there's not really an episode, clearly.
Yeah, and I think that, I mean, you know, to your point about space, you know, the ships being close together and all that kind of stuff. I mean, Richard and I actually had a conversation about this a little while ago, because I watched the first season of The Expanse last weekend. And, you know, I don't know if you've seen that, but it is generally in the vein of, you know, more of a, you know, Battlestar Galactica sort of thing, where it's real physics in space and the ships don't necessarily get very close to each other, you know, and when you fire weapons and things like that. I mean, there's one scene in The Expanse where a ship has torpedoes fired at it, and, you know, they have to sort of, you know, calculate a trajectory, and the torpedoes take quite a while to get to the ship. It's not instantaneous. And, TNG and Star Trek in general is very much in an older, you know, it comes out of the sort of 50s sci-fi, where I don't think that Hollywood writers at the time really understood exactly how big space is, and they sort of treated it more as, you know, air superiority in World War II or something, because that's kind of where they were coming from. You know, I mean, Gene Roddenberry, you know, served in World War II. And so, you know, a lot of the writers of that era had a lot of military combat experience. And I think that just kind of informs where they're coming from. Whereas now I think it's much more of a thing to make space out to be, quote unquote, more realistic.
Well, you know, that's actually pretty interesting, given that, you know, especially the original Star Wars coming out when the space race is at its height, and when we are, you know, first going to the moon, and, you know, when space is this goal that we can do, you know, and it's exciting and we can go. And so, of course, yes, we can eventually imagine, you know, where, you know, things can go faster than light, or, you know, where space is just an ocean, you know, planets are continents, you know, whatever. Now, you know, we never go to space. There are no manned missions to the moon anymore. You know, there is no, you know, we all know at this point.
To be fair, there's nothing on the moon. So.
But you know what I mean? Like but
that's what the government tells you. We know what's
but,
up there.
But to
that's where national health care is. It's on the moon.
But, you know, to be fair, you know, we know that there's nothing on the moon. Like there is. So it is much, it does make a lot more sense to, you know, think of space as space, as drudgery, as, you know, no, it's not, you know, exciting adventures all the time. It's going to be, you know, well, it's easier to have a more cynical or realistic view of space now than it was.
Well, yeah,
in the
90s. And this is getting kind of far afield, but I think that, you know, there was this interesting statistic I read a couple of days ago, which basically said that, you know, if you gave each person in America like an acre of land in Texas, 95% of Texas would still be empty. And so there's this idea that we need to go out into space because we're running out of land, which, you know, frankly, is not true.
Right, anyway. Yeah. Well, you always get that when you fly in an airplane. You know, and you look down and it's just like, you know, for all the complaints about like space and everything, if you fly across this country, you just have, you know, huge swaths of nothing going on that you're flying over. And it's just like, oh, there is a lot of space. It's just when you're on the ground, it's hard to see.
I mean, hell, moving from New York to Portland, you know, Eric and I were going around the other, and there was just like this huge lot, and we're like, oh, there's no space in Portland. You know, we're used to New York being so crammed and overbuilt, and, you know, there's stuff everywhere. You know, it is weird to, you know, that is a different perspective, I guess. But
yeah. No, it's just interesting how the scope of it affects everything. And I think that's something that TNG's scope kind of impedes sometimes. Another thing that's funny about TNG's scope is that What did you guys think about the fact that, was it a mistake or was it right, that there's really no nefarious plot line in this story?
I like that because, you know, I mean, not every, you know, this is a, if we're going through the classic plots, this is a man versus nature plot in a lot of ways. You know, it's just a random disaster. There is no, you know, villain in this episode. And I mean, this is in a way Next Generation. One of the things we talked a lot when we were dealing with Next Generation was how, you know, Roddenberry had this dictum at the very beginning, you know, the cast can't argue with themselves. You know, they all have to be getting along together. You know, they're all working together. And while later, you know, later characters, for example, Ensign Roe was a perfect example of one of those characters who could be at odds with the main cast or could disagree with them. And, you know, frankly, her disagreement with Troy, you know, is a lot of their plot in this episode. But, you know, this is an example of where they could have a life or death plot, but there is nobody to argue against and they can all work together. But it doesn't really impede any of the drama of it, I would say. Because, you know, what they're dealing with is a plasma fire. You know, that's nobody's fault, really. It's just something they have to do. So, you know, we got to figure it out.
And I think it's also important that TNG reminds us every once in a while that space is still dangerous as well. You know, there is something profoundly insane about, you know, sealing yourself into a you know, pressurized tube and hurtling yourself through space at, you know, light speed. I mean, it is something that I think TNG doesn't do nearly as well as maybe like TOS, for example, because, of course, the original series was you know, of an earlier era and definitely did make space out to be perhaps a little more dangerous than TNG. I mean, TNG, you know, a lot has been said about the physical environment of the Enterprise D, where it's, you know, all lush carpets and there's, you know, fish tanks and plants everywhere.
Yep.
You know, and there's a bar and there's like a lounge.
And there's children on the ship.
There's children on the ship. But
it's so comfortable that they don't provide you anything to hold on to when the ship starts to shake. You know, it's like that's so exceptionally rare that people just have to brace themselves against the wall when the ship starts to shake around, which I think is always funny.
Yeah, they don't even have seatbelts, do they?
No. I it's always a interesting thing about like what causes the ship to shake. When they go to light speed, the ship doesn't shake, or they don't show like any inertia or anything like that. But if it gets hit by a cosmic string or quantum filament, it sort of shakes around like crazy.
I don't want to go too far afield and start talking about the Star Trek The Next Generation technical manual that I'm looking at on my bookshelf right now, but I could.
So please don't make him. Don't do it. Oh, God. Change the subject right now.
Is that the soft cover, purple sort of maroon cover manual, I think?
It's actually, I think, yeah, I guess that's right. It's kind of a maroon color. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm sorry. I'm trying to pick it out with between all of the other gigantically long Star Trek books you have. And, you know, just of the manuals, like you have, so I'm sitting right next to the shelf. There are two shelves of just novels.
Yep.
Then there's another shelf that's just like manuals and like episode guides and all of that.
Is that a problem?
It's not enough, Eric.
I'm working on it, okay?
The novels are always interesting to me. They're just it's weird too. I can't imagine being an author who bases my work off of some other like property. That seems a little bit odd to me. I always enjoyed the books when I read them. It's just a funny type thing.
I don't know if it's regular work. It doesn't pay too badly.
That's and you know it's a property that someone's sure to buy, which is the nice thing.
Yeah,
that's the other thing too.
Does anyone feel that the subtext of this episode is that Riker is having an affair with Keiko O'Brien? Does that correct? My wife was who gets upset when I call her my wife. So Amy was saying that she was watching this and she just like. First, Riker is the first one to reach out and grab a pregnant woman's stomach, which is always kind of a weird thing. And then he's when she's on the ground, he's just clutching her face for no particular reason as he's kneeling over her.
And he wants the child to be named William.
Yes.
And he comes, you know, Molly comes out and she's got a beard.
She's got a beard
and a trombone.
I kind of feel like Riker is just one of those guys that's very egotistical and very earthy.
Yeah.
I don't think that there's any sort of nefarious plot behind this. Although that would make the line in Defiant, the DS9 episode, where O'Brien sees Riker, who's pretending to be Will Riker and is actually Tom Riker, the duplicate, when he says, "You know what you did."
Yeah,
you know, it would.
That adds, some, do you guys? Got I don't know if you talked about it in that episode, but is the reason he says that to O'Brien just so that O'Brien won't continue talking to him?
Yeah, I think so.
I didn't get that. Yeah,
I think it's just a way for Tom Riker to shut it down, so O'Brien doesn't start saying, "Hey, remember when you, me, and Keiko had a three-way?" They don't. Yeah. What does my dick look like?
It was confusing that O'Brien just sort of gave up. I feel if someone I knew for that long came up and was just like, "You know what you did," I'd be like, "I don't remember what I did. I'm sorry for that."
But I think that O'Brien is always one of those characters that's just really he has too much work and he's really tired of your shit and just doesn't want to deal with it.
What if this is like a later it turns out in a later episode that like it's revealed that O'Brien actually did something really bad like to Riker like that we just didn't see and like that's a flashback and so you spoiled it for me.
Or just O'Brien is just stewing about what actually happened. Well, there's a nice segue for you. I was you guys are on Deep Space Nine now. I found the bridge scenes on this one to be very DS9, and that's really just because Ro is present.
But yeah, given that it is about disagreement, you know, between three characters, you know, trying to I can see that.
And I think you know, in a sort of non-professional. Well, they're professional, but they're still sort of willing to yell at each other a little bit.
Yeah, and I think that you know it's funny you say that because I can see that and you know it does kind of feed into the fact that and we talked about this a little bit when we talked about TNG about how the show was really good at sort of picking up on minor you know individual siloed plot points or characters or alien races and DS9 really took them and ran with them. I mean you know it's a complete accident that for example the Cardassians even exist because in their first episode they were supposed to be the Romulans and I think Rick Berman is the one who said look let's not use the Romulans let's come up with something else. Perhaps one of the only you know good contributions Rick Berman ever made to Star Trek but that's neither here nor there. And so I think that, you know, if you look at Ensign Ro and she's a Bajoran, she is someone who has come from a very, very a challenged, disadvantaged background, being a refugee from the Cardassian occupation. Yeah, I definitely can see that. And she is, you know, it's something that I don't know is intentional, but I think it's something that is really indicative of the way that, you know, sort of that early mid-90s Star Trek was able to sort of, while DS9 is doing very different things than TNG did, it is still Star Trek, and they're able to pick up on and build on a sort of coherent worldview in a certain sense.
Well, I found it kind of interesting that, they make it clear that, you know, immediately once it's realized that there are people in the engineering, you know, Ro does immediately apologize to Troy, you know, and...
I thought that was a mistake. You finished, but I thought it was a mistake.
Well, because, you know, Troy ends up saying, like, you know, you could have easily been right. And, I mean, I think it's making it clear that, you know, Ro was, you know, in this particular case, Ro was incorrect in that, you know, there were people, you know, to be saved. But there is a version of and there is no way that we would think that Troy would let that portion of the ship go. But, I mean, we see a few examples in DS9, frankly, where Ro's position, you know, oh, let them go, you know, where that was the right decision or that is what characters choose to do. I mean, in a way, this is introducing that there are going to be some situations where that is the right thing to do. It's bringing a bit more of a complexity to the universe that it doesn't really pick up till DS9. It doesn't really have the ability to pick up till DS9, but that it's interesting that that exists at least as a possibility in this space this early.
Yeah, I'm sort of torn about that. I understand what they're doing with the Ro character here. I read something. Michael Piller thought they had made a writing mistake in having her. This is Ro's second appearance after Ensign Ro. He thought that he made a mistake in having her be dead wrong in her second appearance. I don't know if I'd call her dead wrong, but I would say that her position, the argument they're having about what they should do is not 100% like drawing me in, sort of. Like, it's not, there's not stakes there that I'm really interested in what the outcome is, because does Troy make the right decision here?
I mean, I think so.
She does. She leads to – she. You know, if she didn't decide to, you know, leave the ship and, you know, make the line to engineering, you know, then Data – that's what Data and Riker end up picking up and, you know, whatever Data does, you know, saves the day enough to that it won't blow up.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's you know, I don't know that it's a mistake. I mean, I think that you know, Ensign Ro, at least in her first appearance, was – she was introduced as someone who was a hot-headed problem. And – I definitely can, I mean, you know, I think it's, you know, it's unfortunate that Ensign Ro, I think, only appears, what, four times in TNG or something like that? She's
seven actually, but she's, wow. I was surprised she's front loaded in season five. There's five appearances in season five.
Well, because, you know, for me, it really speaks to the difference between the ways in which TNG used recurring guest stars and the way in which DS9 uses recurring guest stars, because TNG definitely seems to forget about the existence of Ensign Ro, and in a way that DS9 never forgets about the existence of Gul Dukat or Garak, yeah, or you know, a number of recurring characters.
Yep.
And so
she only exists in those seven appearances. You can't ask the question, well, what did she do in season six during this episode, when, you know, you can't even make it up. You know, you can say, well, what was Gul Dukat doing at that time? Well, you know, here he was working on this, you know, whatever. Yep.
Right, there's much less of an understanding that this is a timeline, and much more of a sense that these are siloed adventures. That if they need Ensign Ro for an episode, they'll call up Michelle Forbes and see if she's available.
Yeah.
But what I like about, I think it's consistent with Ensign Ro's character for her to argue with Troy. I also think that it's consistent with Troy's character to try and build some sort of consensus, because, you know, that's what Troy does. And she is a very reasonable person. I also like the fact that these are two strong, capable women that are having a disagreement that, while it's a little heated, is professional. And at the end of the day, they're also able to come to an understanding at the end. I mean,
I think it's very clear that they, you know, part of, I think, the apology is the two of them acknowledging to each other that the heatedness was not a personal thing between them. It was, you know, dealing with the fact that they make the wrong decision, they're all dead.
Yes.
You know, they are dealing with something that is very stressful, high stakes, and, you know, they need to make the exact right decision here. So
the apology to me is a little weird, because it feels to me it would be more in Ro's character to be like, you were right this time, but what if you had been wrong? You know, sort of that feels like a very Ensign Ro thing to say back to her. I don't mind the apology, just because it's sort of like a TNG, like, oh, we got to wrap up now, and like, we can't have these characters fuming at each other for the remainder of the series.
I can definitely see that, but I kind of read the apology a little bit differently, where I think it's hard to say anything definitive about Ensign Ro, because, again, she is in so few episodes, and I don't know that we ever get a fully rounded sense of what she's like as a person. But we only see her ever in certain situations that, of course, brings out different sides of her personality. But to me, that apology reads much more like Ensign Ro trying to fit in the ways in which the Enterprise crew does things.
You know, that's kind of along what I was saying. If we may, we're okay with spoiling a little bit of DS9, aren't we?
Yeah, go ahead.
Because we're dealing, you know, at this point, Eric and I are recording season four, and so Worf has joined the cast. And, you know, we've been talking a bunch about how he's fitting in, and he's had to, you know, he is used to the Enterprise at this point, you know, and DS9 things are different, and he's learning how to, you know, for example, how to give orders, you know, in a DS9 kind of fashion, how to deal with elements like Quark and, you know, which didn't exist on the Enterprise. And so, you know, Ro is almost dealing with the opposite of that story, or more, you know, chronologically, Worf is dealing with the opposite of Ro's story, where she has come up from, you know, she was in prison for a while, you know, she is learning how to do things the Enterprise way in a lot of ways. And, you know, I think she, because the Enterprise does accept her, even even though she doesn't necessarily see eye to eye, you know, in all of the ways, but I don't know. It didn't feel weird to me, but I don't know. I always wish they had done more with Ro.
Yeah,
my understanding was that she was supposed to take the Kira role on DS9, right?
Yeah. She was, yeah.
Which, and this is way ahead, so I'm going to say just one sentence, and then we're going to move on. It's weird to me that the penultimate TNG episode is a Ro Laren episode.
Yeah,
we thought that was weird too. But anyway,
outside of that, I think Ro's. Rose suffers from, I think, what you were talking about, the show has a different understanding of how guest stars are supposed to work, where Rose's personality kind of doesn't make a lot of sense to me, in a way that she's treated by the rest of the cast. Like, to me, the only character that really stands up to her in any sort of chain of command is Riker. Riker frequently yells at her about things, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's understandable because she does give her superior officers quite a bit of sass. You know what I mean? Like, it's to a point where you start to wonder about, like, is she just being difficult, or do the other characters not want to fight back against this? It's interesting. And as much as I like her personality.
Well, and frankly, a lot of the Riker standing up to her is, doesn't that turn out to be just sexual tension?
He wants to put his pee in her.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I think, well, the other thing too, and I could be wrong about this, but wasn't Ro initially a higher rank than she is now? Wasn't she busted down to Ensign because she, I forget exactly what the circumstances are, why she was in prison. I think so. And so that could speak to it too, maybe, where she's used to being afforded a little bit more latitude in pushing back against her commanding officers because she used to be a higher rank.
I didn't remember if it was a higher rank or simply like she's Riker's age and he's so much higher than her because she's been in prison for the, you know, I think there may be, well, that may be some part of it too. I'm not sure either way.
Well, and I also think frankly too that you know, the Enterprise, you know, I think that what we see in Star Trek, and I think we see, you know, we've been talking, you know, a little bit about DS9 here, that each starship and each sort of starbase, you know, maybe run a little differently, you know.
Yeah.
And so yep. Ensign Ro just might have come from a starship that was run a little bit more aggressively than the Enterprise is.
Yeah. Mm. No, I can, they have some interaction with an episode where Captain's just like, well, he's being a little sarcastic with Picard. He's like, well, we can't all have the luxury liner. Some of us just do like transport missions back and forth between star bases. That would be a sad thing. We are looking at like the best of the best here, I guess, in terms of their adventures.
That's it. Go again back to DS9. There's one where, you know, Bashir meets an old, you know, classmate of his who went on, you know, one of the big starships, and she's saying, oh my God, it's so boring. Like, we're just like charting stars all the time.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And I guess that's what those, you know, we had a few days of downtime is supposed to be. Like, they're just doing really, you know, basic surveying stuff, you know, stuff that, you know, for example, Crusher doesn't really get involved in, you know, but the stellar cartography team is, you know, for example, that week they're busy.
Yeah, very, very, very excited.
Oh boy, stellar cartography number one.
they got their blue shirts out and ironed them very crisply and then just head out the door. So
that would be a great spinoff.
Yeah, they should always do a stellar Enterprise stellar cartography or whatever, just so one season.
Brian Fuller, give us a call.
I was going to say, that's, you know, we will write this for Brian Fuller.
That's what the people want, Brian. So I'm going to get out on a ledge here and just say that this is the best Troy storyline that they've ever done, mostly because I felt it was very satisfying and it didn't piss me off on some level.
It is a good Troy story.
I mean,
that's all I had to say about
Richard,
it.
Richard, just leaving that hanging in the air.
She's not in a relationship, as far as I can tell, which is nice. That's a plus. She's not complaining about losing her powers, which is a plus.
Mm-hmm.
Her powers are actually useful here in a realistic way. She can tell that people are alive, you know, which gives her sort of a insights into her rationale as to what she's choosing to do.
It doesn't involve her mother.
Doesn't involve her mother. She makes her own decision, and she grows as a character over the course of this episode, which is summed up in the two great lines where I think the writing of this script is really tight. It's really it moves very quickly, and there's Ron Moore, who wrote it, does a lot of work with two lines. He does it starts off the Troy story with she makes the mistake about calling it a cosmic string, and O'Brien's like, not really, you know, this is totally different. And then it moves into her final line is, we'll do what we do when I tell you to do it, which is just it's a nice development between those two points.
Well, yeah, I thought the episode would be originally be her like, oh, what am I going to do and how do we get – but when she finally comes to – you know, she does dig her heels in when, you know, she completely shoots – you know, She considers Rose's suggestion, but no, we're doing this. We're, you know, this is, I am completely disagreeing with you. You know, there is a degree to which Ro is trying to intimidate Troy a little bit, and Troy's not taking any of it.
Yeah. Well, and I think too, I mean, watching TNG, I think we finished it almost a year ago at this point, but rewatching the whole show, you know, as an adult was a really instructive experience, because characters that I maybe necessarily did not think very highly of, or did not think were very good characters, like Troy or like Lawaksana Troy. I mean, the two Troys are kind of the perfect example of bad Star Trek characters. I mean, I did not come around to Wesley Crusher, for example. I still think right. Wesley Crusher was a huge misfire. But, you know, Troy is one of those characters that, you know, if you want to talk about how women in Hollywood are written generally, they're usually written by men. And I don't think that men necessarily know exactly what to do with female characters on television shows sometimes, unless they put them into a relationship or make them hysterical. You know, which obviously is ridiculous and sexist. And so I think that there's a real difference between Troy episodes, quote unquote, at which are usually not very good because the writer doesn't know what to do with Troy, except remember that she has, you know, lady parts and yep. is going to use them, because how can you write an episode that has a woman in it unless she's having sex with a man? It's yeah. crazy. You know, you can't do yep. it. Which is interesting, because one of the best, I mean, the best Troy episode, bar none, is Face of the Enemy.
Yeah.
So, and I think the other thing, too, is when Troy, I really grew to appreciate Troy in this rewatch, because when the show is using her in a supplementary capacity, like they are in Disaster, she's a great character.
Yeah.
Yeah. We were talking, you know, just the two of us, and never saying, like, it would have been interesting if she had been the one who went over to DS9, because, you know, put her in a situation where everybody's lying, where she does, you know, people would need to do some infiltration missions, and, you know, Face of the Enemy demonstrates she's really good at her powers are very good at picking her way through a very unfamiliar situation.
Yeah.
So,
yeah
when they, it is a shame that they never quite figure out how to use her, because at the, you know, episodes like this where she is able to thrive, and where Marina Sirtis is able to thrive as well, are really good.
Yeah.
Yeah, she's not forced to do hysterics in this one, which is nice. You'd think, going on previous information, she'd have like a breakdown or something. That does not happen, which is nicely refreshing. She's perfectly capable in this episode. And I think if I had to pick a storyline, I'd say this is a Troy, like, she's the A storyline. It's not a Troy episode, but it's sort of like her arc is kind of the major one.
I feel like in the Netflix description, it even focuses, you know, when the Enterprise is, you know, taken by not a cosmic string, Troy must become command or something mm-hmm. like that.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. How they choose to sell it. What did you guys think? Let's see. Before we go, we don't need to go through each one. What storyline did you like the most, and which one did you like the least out of all of these, and for what reason?
Well, I think the one that I liked the most was the Troy Bridge story. I think it's very, very strong. I think I always like it when I see female characters on a television show that are, you know, being treated respectfully and like people. And I think that this one, you know, that storyline in this episode does that very well. I think the one that I like the least is a combination of the Riker and Data storyline and the Geordi and Beverly storylines, just because I don't feel like they completely earn the screen time that they take up. You know, they
pick
do
one or the other.
Yeah, they do have their charms, and I think that if I had to go with one or the other, I would probably have cut the Geordi and Beverly stuff, just because I don't know that it really teaches us much about the characters, and it's not that entertaining to watch.
Theirs feels the most disconnected to me.
Yeah.
Like, it's not really they're kind of in – they're in a same situation, but it feels like it's totally disconnected from all the other plot lines.
Yeah, even Riker and Data at the end, they're the ones who, you know, close the circle and fix it. You know,
right.
Even if, you know, we haven't really talked at all about the Picard storyline, which is, you know, fine, it has kids, but, you know,
yeah, it's fine.
You know, he's still the captain, you know, and so that is a very significant, you know, and to have a situation in which the captain is, you know, physically injured, you know, is certainly a, you know, and has to depend on children to get out of it.
But I do think that the Picard storyline is interesting, because it does butt up against the sort of societal or cultural belief or expectation that if you don't want kids, you must hate them. And, yeah. you know, speaking as someone who likes kids, fine, but doesn't necessarily want to have my own, I think that it's good that Picard, you know, Picard's a little uncomfortable around children. He doesn't necessarily know how to talk to them. Pro tip, Picard, you just talk to them like people. Kids yep. like it when you're sarcastic. And also that you know, he's able to sort of figure out what to do in the situation. It turns out that Picard is actually pretty good with kids. And I like that. I like that storyline. I wouldn't want to see that one go away.
But, I mean, it you know, that does fit into the larger arc of Picard, which isn't something that has been, you know, hugely – but, I mean, he does start at the very beginning. I mean, that's one of the very first things he tells Riker is that he doesn't like kids. And he's, you know, in – what the fuck is the name?
Farpoint?
First episode. Farpoint, yes. Yeah. You know, in Farpoint, he tells Riker, you know, I really don't want to be around the kids. I'm not comfortable being around kids. And, you know, this is an episode which starts off. He's like, we're not going to the bridge. We're going to show you stellar cartography. Isn't that yeah. fascinating? You know, and by the end, you know, he's had such a fun time. You know, he's taking them to the battle bridge. And, you know, he thinks it's awesome. And, I mean, this eventually going where Generations goes, which is dealing with, you know, and whether or not we like Generations, which, you know, spoiler alert, we don't. you know, the fact that Picard did not, you know, chose his career over family, you know, ultimately yeah. that that does kind of contextualize his discomfort with children. I mean, because to a degree, he's almost, you know, letting his discomfort take over because he doesn't get to have that, you know?
Yeah.
You know, well, I'm not going to be upset about the fact that I never had children because I don't like them anyway.
Right. Yeah. He's chosen his thing and he's worked in his justification. It feels to me a little bit, right before this episode, we had the Silicon Avatar, which is the return and death of the crystalline entity. It's funny to me that at this point, some of the things they bring up, I'm almost like, maybe the show should just forget about that. You know, like Picard's hatred of children isn't as bad, but like the crystalline entity.
Oh, when that was so tragic.
When it returned, but it really feels it's just like, oh yeah, this was something from the first season.
Or like in the seventh season when they decide that what they really need to do is bring Damon Bach back, and you're like, why?
Right, yes. It's only let's bring back an annoying race at this point in TNG, let's bring back one of the worst of that race to, you know, cover everything up.
I don't know. I will justify the crystalline entity because they did manage to take that plot into the very TNG even this could be communicated with, and that it ended on such a tragic note, I did really – like – that's one episode I remember very well just because it did end so – it was just such a sad and missed opportunity. And,
yeah,
you know, this TNG in general rarely ends on so bleak a note.
Mm-hmm.
Well, my co-host Clay calls them Data's cold as ice moments where he – a lot of Data episodes end with him just being brutally unemotional to somebody.
Yeah.
And it's always satisfying. It's always like, yeah, that's the way a Data episode should end. It's just kind of a funny little quirk that they have. I'm going to say this is Michael Dorn and I think her name is Rosalind Chow. This
yeah.
easily some of their best work.
Oh, yeah.
Rosalind Chow for 100%.
Who is Keiko. They're both good in it.
You may now give birth. Yeah.
Yes.
Her labor lasts like 15 minutes. You know, my mother, you know, always did, when I was a kid, anytime it would be bad, I was 23 hours in labor with you. You know,
it does happen sometimes though, that labor does go very quickly.
Oh no, I know. You know, I just think that's funny. Like this is over the course of like 4 hours at most.
Well, it's even written in the script. Worf can't believe how quickly her labor is going. This isn't the way the simulation went or whatever he brings up.
It does make me wonder how Klingon women give birth. I mean, do they just kind of like do it themselves? And
they just cut it out.
Yeah. They just they take a batleth and they're just like, get the fuck out of my body, child.
Well, I'm thinking about the Good Earth in which, you know, she in the middle of labor, she's working in the fields, and then, you know, she goes by for an hour, gives birth, and, you know, swaddles the baby on her back and goes back. That's what the, you know, Klingon women do.
Yeah.
The Klingon women are, we always think that the Klingon women are one of the more strongly drawn subsets, because the Klingon women are always the pushy in terms of, like, sexual interaction, you know? Like, female Klingons are always sort of, like, they're basically sexually harassing the men. kind of. Like, every time you see them, that's the way that they've chosen to draw them. They're very forward with how they pursue things, which makes sense in context of their culture, I guess.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, absolutely.
So, I mean, them giving birth would, I assume, be along the same lines. I could see them wanting men to have nothing to do with it, and that would be the way about it. So, Worf's cluelessness here makes sense to me. I thought everyone's... I think the cast is settling nicely. Everyone's interactions here are very nice. Frakes and Spiner. Just the sort of way they play their interactions when they talk to each other in this one. You want me to detach your head or whatever Riker says.
Yeah.
It's very comfortable in their roles at this point, which I can feel that in the show at this point. It feels... We talked about how they're calling up stuff from earlier seasons. It feels like the show is hitting that turning point right now, where it's going to start getting really self-referential, and it's going to start becoming aware of itself in a way that the previous seasons weren't. That's about it. Great lighting in this episode too, actually. I enjoy when the show gets dark as opposed to the washed out bright lights of every other episode.
Then you are going to love a seventh season episode in which everybody devolves. Spoiler alert.
I love that episode. I freely admit that's a terrible episode, but I love watching it. I don't know why.
Okay, so I just have one question, though. At the beginning, they're talking about the baby, Molly, you know, as it turns out, as if it's a boy. And they're, you know, oh, what's his name going to be, you know? And at the end of the episode, it's a girl. So I'm very confused.
I don't know why. Yeah, do they have a discussion about they don't want to know? I don't remember
that's what I assumed, yeah.
Yeah, it was just, it was weird.
Yeah,
it was maybe just supposed to be dialogue that was not intentional. I mean, I don't know. It's hard to say. I mean,
but, you know, does this have anything to do with Spot changing from boy cat to girl cat?
Or even kind of cat. It changes from, it turns into the orange cat eventually, but at some point, when it's
is Spot a changeling?
Oh my God, this is our fan theory. We've blown the entire series open.
Yeah, I think that they probably were just supposed to assume that Keiko and Miles.
Yeah, but you
didn't
think they'd say like,
sex.
Okay, well, it's going to be William if it's a boy, or Janie Lee if it's a girl.
Well, you know that Miles really wanted a boy.
Yeah,
and
they're very disappointed that this is a girl. I think that's
I mean, it's Molly. Wouldn't you be disappointed if you had a kid and it was Molly?
Molly's fine.
It's the perfect name choice for that character, I think. In a way, like, just, I guess it's the O'Brien sort of Irish thing, but just like Molly O'Brien, it couldn't be any better than that.
Yeah,
she'll go on to great things, Joe. So everyone can look forward to that. All right. Well, I think we've talked Disaster into the ground. It's an interesting episode. So many storylines. We talked about Bev and Geordi. Oh, I do want to bring up one last thing. Do you think Geordi? How high on Geordi's priority list is making the button that makes the air come back into the shuttle bay closer to the button that opens the door? On the
right.
I think he's probably going to hotwire it into the comm badges at this point. I think tap four times on your comm badge to repressurize the bay. Like,
yeah.
I think that's probably that's probably a good thing.
I feel that storyline was not really great.
Also, why did both of them have to be, like, one couldn't one be at the console and the other be by the button? Like,
well, the thing was that they needed to hang on to something or else they would have been sucked into
space. You think that maybe they needed to put maybe that's another engineering choice. They need to put a bar by everything.
Yeah, that's just a safety feature, like like an old person's shower. They have that bar they can hold on to.
I think you're probably seeing the limits of, you know, the sort of clean future aesthetic in a way.
Yes.
Because,
yeah.
You know, this kind of thing didn't happen on Battlestar Galactica or a lot of other shows because there was shit everywhere.
Yeah, yes. That's true. Yeah. And, you know, we just watched The Matrix and, like, what you could hold, you could hold on to. There's, like, wires and pipes everywhere. Like, it's really, you don't have to worry.
Yes. Like, in the walls, there's so much stuff that you can just grab. I have studs everywhere, convenient studs everywhere when you're in the wall trying to protect yourself.
Well, yeah, like, you know, Keanu Reeves and Lawrence Fishburne and, you know, Al Perino. They're pretty.
But it does make me think, though, that out of all the places on a starship that you might want to have emergency spacesuits or gravity boots, it might be that the shuttle bay.
Just like something that you could hook a carabiner onto, you know, a bungee cord.
They showed it in that episode, The Hunted, where they have the super soldier that breaks loose on the Enterprise. He goes into one of the shuttle bays and he pulls out like a prepackaged spacesuit, and they all think that he went outside the ship. So they are in there. They just weren't thinking very clearly about what they need to do.
Well, when you have oxygen deprivation, it does, you know, she does say that it, you know, makes you confused. And
yeah, very quickly. I don't know if it happens that quick. I feel the one biggest problem in that sequence, besides the fact that it's not particularly exciting, is just the fact that I really think they screwed up the direction of them trying to get to the button. I know that sounds like a weird complaint, but Geordi goes down like a sack of potatoes immediately. And Beverly just, there's a cut where Beverly walks past him, and the next cut is just her at the panel, and she hits the thing. Like, I needed a little bit more of a, you know, dramatic, like a lot of angles of them crawling slowly. It happens very quickly.
I think that's a side effect of having too many stories. They just didn't have the time to make it
Editors didn't give a shit about that plot at that point.
It's probably the first thing to cut. They're like, well, we have 17 minutes of Geordi crawling to the shuttle, to the button. Like, cut it down to 10 seconds.
He insisted on doing it, like, you know, until it was perfect.
It's another callback. This is another episode where Geordi gets knocked on his ass by something, which is we haven't seen in a while, but it's good to see it, where the plasma fire explodes and it knocks him backwards. Always good to have those moments.
Poor Geordi. Geordi just never, you know.
He was the punching bag of TNG in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
A couple of my other guest stars hate Geordi. What are your opinions on Geordi?
I mean, I loved Geordi as a kid because I loved reading Rainbow, but like as an adult watching it,
he's kind of lame.
Yeah, I wouldn't hang out with him.
No, he's a dork. And I don't mean that in a bad way, but
not in a good way either.
Yeah, I don't think that he would be very fun. And I don't think that he necessarily has deep philosophical conversations. I think he probably is a lot like Scotty, except for the drinking. And, you know, as we all know, Scotty just liked to hang out in his room and read technical manuals all the time.
I mean, Scotty would at least be fun.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I mean, Geordi basically does what Scotty does, only Geordi's not drunk.
Right.
So
it all comes out.
Scotty could get a nice lass if he needed to. You know, Geordi can't.
I feel I agree with that as like a character thing. I feel that Geordi, the storylines that Geordi gets as a character are not storylines that are suited to LeVar Burton, who I feel like LeVar Burton is kind of a, you know, he's a pretty charismatic actor. He's not a great actor, but he has a certain charisma that I think can carry a lot of storylines, and they choose to give him none of those storylines.
Well, yeah, that's the thing. I wouldn't have a beer with Geordi, but I would with LeVar Burton.
Sure.
Right. Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I've seen LeVar Burton at conventions and he's great. So, you know, there is that too.
You can read together.
That's right. Hey, I funded his Kickstarter for a dollar. Anyway, let's wrap it up. I'm going to play an audio clip. Me, Eric, and Richard are going to come back. We're going to give our final thoughts and ratings for Disaster.
The OBN conduit, sir.
Got it.
Yes, sir. You must now change the input matrix of my secondary optical port and then connect the OBN conduit. That is not the correct port, sir.
Sorry.
You must hurry, Commander. The containment field has dropped to 16%.
I'm trying. I need a bigger head.
The field continues to drop, sir. Collapse is imminent.
Try it now.
I have made a connection, sir. I am now stabilizing the containment field.
Sir, the field strength is stabilizing. 18%. 20. 25.
I guess they got our message. I was wrong, Counselor. You could have easily been right.
Final thoughts, Disaster. So, guys, I think you're familiar. We do a rating on 1 to 5. If you want to just give a little summation about what you thought in this episode, 1 is a terrible episode, 5 is a fantastic. Where do you guys stand on Disaster?
Oh, well, I would give this 3.5 Troys out of 5. Sure. No, I like this one. This is a very good, solid, you know, solid adventure episode. It has a lot of good character work. Maybe it would be stronger if either if the Geordi Crusher plot were cut or made more interesting. As it were, it was very good to watch again, and I had fun with it, and I would watch this a third time.
Okay. I will give it a 3.75 out of 5, just to be difficult.
Sure.
And Disaster is one of those episodes, you know, I kind of slot TNG episodes into two different like columns, like episodes that if I just want to watch a TNG episode, I'll put it on, and episodes that if I just want to watch a TNG episode, I probably won't put on.
Yes.
And Disaster is definitely in the latter camp for me. I don't, it's not an episode that I kind of remember exists, but whenever I watch it, I do enjoy it. And I think that, you know, one of the things that I don't think TNG gets enough credit for is being a little experimental in its structure sometimes. And so I like the fact that the show at this point in the early fifth season is so confident that it is able to sort of go outside of the standard A plot, B plot dynamic of most of TNG's episodes and do something a little different. And also, you know, take characters that don't necessarily interact with each other all that much on the show and throw them together and see what happens. And I think it's a testament both to the comfort that you spoke of earlier with the actors kind of being comfortable in their roles at this point, and the comfort that the writers have in writing for them at this point, knowing what their reactions would be and knowing what their reactions would be to the situation and characters that they don't necessarily have a lot in common with or even deal with on an everyday basis. So I like it. It's a good episode.
Yeah. It's sort of a interesting sweet spot for me. I'm going to give it a 4 out of 5. I think that I really always like the high concept Star Trek episodes. I like high concept sci-fi in general. And this one is sort of a high concept episode, but it's also avoids the pitfall that a lot of high concept stuff has where the characters don't make a lot of sense. The example I would always give is Identity Crisis, the one where Geordi turns into like an alien. That is a high concept episode that completely ignores what the characters are about. And that is why it fails in that regard, where this one is, you know, the pitch is just, you know, the ship gets hit by something and everyone's locked down, total disaster. It's like, oh, that's good. That'll be fun. And it's also nicely fits into how all the characters interact with each other. So it actually makes sense within the TNG universe. And I like that kind of stuff. I like this episode. It's a 4 out of 5 for me. And I think that it's one that I always think about when I'm in the little Netflix queue or whatever, looking at the breakdowns of what's going on. Cool. Well, guys, thank you very much for coming on.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
If people are interested, where can they find you doing your current run through of Deep Space Nine?
They can find us at trekaboutshow.com.
Check them out, guys. They're very good. They're doing a lot more of these episodes than I've ever done, and they're probably in year 7 of this project. Chronicle doing their own little version of Stellar Cartography. I can't say Stellar Cartography very easily. They should rename that.
We've been doing this so long that we're all gray by now.
And we can say Stellar Cartography really easily.
It's the most important department. Guys, thank you very much. If you're on YouTube, like and comments, appreciate it. If you enjoyed the content, you're on rating. You want to give a rating on iTunes, that's always appreciated as well. Eric, Richard, I hope you guys have a wonderful day. Thank you for coming on to talk about Disaster. And I'll send everybody over to trekaboutshow.com. And guys, I'll see you later.